This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. So how should an objectivist answer the charge that minorities will suffer unfairly without anti-discrimination laws? I think an objectivist has to recognize that it's true. They would, in certain circumstances. Without anti-discrimination laws, there are racists out there who would discriminate, and it would be unjust and unfair. I think what we have to commit ourselves is to fighting against that. That is, fighting from a voluntary perspective. If a restaurant will not serve Jews or blacks or yellows or whatever, don't go to that restaurant. That is social boycott, social ostracization. That's the way to deal with bad people who are not initiating force, but who are just immoral and bad and unjust. And I think we need to commit ourselves as objectivists to fighting that. But you also have to respond with a flip side. What about the unfair discrimination against majorities? And at the end of the day, the only minority or the most prevalent minority is the individual. So why should one individual be discriminated against because of anti-discrimination laws? Affirmative action, for example, where some kid won't get into college because of these laws, other people get to jump the line. That's not fair. That's not just either. So you're replacing one form of injustice with another form of injustice. And the difference between the two is that the anti-discrimination laws are laws. There's nothing you can do to fight them. It's coercion. It's force. It's a violation of individual rights. So here, discrimination is by law. The law dictates you must discriminate. That is horrific. Much worse, in my view, than when people voluntarily discriminate. Now, I still think it's wrong to discriminate. But if somebody does it voluntarily, you can act against that person by not associating with them, by not dealing with them, by not patronizing them, whatever, right? But what do you do when it's the law? There's nothing you can do. You're stuck. There's no recourse. Or if you see somebody being discriminated against, you can help them voluntarily, right? You can invite them into your restaurant. You can compete with the discriminator. You can hire them into your company and gain a competitive advantage because they were let go not because of their ability, but because of their race. And you only hire based on ability. You would outcompete the other side. And again, you could argue against it. You could discriminate against the discriminator. But once it's law, there's nothing you can do. So I think laws that discriminate are far worse than what you would consider voluntary discrimination. Do you think Barry Goldwater or an identical character, if there were one, would be able to get the Republican nomination in 2016? No, I don't think so. I mean, Barry Goldwater was a unique combination of advocate for capitalism, who was on many social issues quite liberal. He believed in freedom of individual thought. Now, he wasn't perfect. Ayn Rand wrote about the imperfections of Barry Goldwater, and he still played the religion card, but he didn't anywhere near the way the religion card is played today. So Barry Goldwater, I don't think, could win today because he wouldn't be religious enough. And he would be too good on the economics and bad from the religious rights perspective, from the evangelical perspective, from the Republican basis perspective on social issues. So I suspect that Barry Goldwater would support gay marriage. I think Barry Goldwater supported abortion. And if you hold those views, I don't think you can get elected today in the Republican Party, no matter what you think in terms of the Constitution, in terms of economic rights, in terms of individual rights on other issues. So there's a question that asks, I've said that there's no such thing as state rights. All that exists are individual rights. But in that case, what would be the difference between the role of the federal government and the role of state governments? It seems like if everybody has to protect individual rights,
there wouldn't be much difference between the state governments. And that's true. They wouldn't be. All state governments would be required to defend individual rights. They'd all have their police forces and the judiciary. And there'd be very little differences between them. But there might be some. They're optional things. For example, specific definitions of property rights can be optional. And you might have different states doing it a little differently. It couldn't be dramatically different so that one is clearly a violation of individual rights. But there might be some optionality in terms of doing that. Or there might be optionality with regard to sentencing of certain crimes. Some states might have death penalties under certain circumstances and other states might not. And it might not be clear cut that the death penalty is either pro or not having a death sentence is anti-individual rights or having one is anti-individual rights. Again, there's certain optionalities within the scope of individual rights, and that's where different states could have different regimes. But in a United States of America, which has one constitution and should be guided specifically and only by the principle of protection of individual rights, and the Constitution should be written only from that perspective, there would be very few differences between the states. And generally, governments would be very small. There'd be very little for them to do. Legislatures at the federal level wouldn't have to meet all year round. They'd probably have to meet a couple of months a year. The Texas legislature meets once every 2 years for a year and then takes a year off, I think. I think even that is too much for most state legislatures. They'd meet maybe 6 months every 2 years. So it would be a relatively small thing to be a state legislature. You'd have a job on the side. And that's, I think, the Founding Fathers' vision for these things. Government would be tiny, and it would be responsible for very few things. And those things, some of them are complicated, but they're not that complicated, and they don't have a nap often. But if you think about the world today, where they run the country, every aspect of your life, they regulate everyone, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of pages of regulations and laws and restrictions and how do you do this and who you favor there and who do you subsidize and who do you penalize and who do you tax and who do you don't tax and which favors do you give to whom, all of that. Now it's complicated. So now you have to have a full-time Congress. But that's because they're abusing their power. So there wouldn't be much difference between states. States in and of themselves do not have rights. Only individuals have rights. Libertarians, and especially anarchists, are fond of citing what they call the non-aggression principle as the centerpiece of their ideology and the source of their rights. I find this law, Favel, inadequate. Can you please provide an expose on exactly what's wrong with it? Well, I mean, a short podcast is probably not the right place for this because it's probably a much longer analysis. But I would ask, where does this non-aggression principle come from? Why should we not aggress against one another? It isn't common sense. As the libertarians say, it's self-evident. No, it's not. Indeed, nobody except libertarians and objectivists believe in the non-aggression principle. Everybody agrees that it's okay to aggress against other people if the cause is a good cause. If we vote to take somebody's money, that's okay. Or if taking somebody's money will help somebody else, that's okay. Or if taking somebody's money is going to build roads, that's okay. So where do you get this non-aggression principle? What is the foundation? How are you going to convince people that non-aggression is a good thing? Where does it come from? It's axiomatic, but axiomatic has to be self-evident. And it has to assume that every other piece of knowledge contradicts the negation of the axiom. But here, it's not axiomatic. It has to lie on some foundation. Because the fact is that nobody holds a non-aggression principle. And it's not self-evident. People have been aggressing against one another since the beginning of time. Indeed, it is a massive achievement to get to the point where you can say force is evil. We should extract the initiation of force from human society. But to do that, you have to go through a whole sequence, a whole logical sequence, starting with the nature of man. Man is, well, you really start with metaphysics, with reality is what it is, and you have to be able to prove the efficacy of reason, and reason's man's basic means of survival, and that life, the purpose of morality and the purpose of life is to live for yourself, is your life as an individual, and therefore, and because the way we live our life is by using our reason, applying our reason to the problem of survival, and that force is an enemy of reason, therefore, because my life is the standard, your life is your standard, force is out. But otherwise, where does it come from? Because you don't like force? because there's blood involved, because some people die. People die all the time. So there has to be a reason. It has to come from somewhere. And their argument about, well, morality has to come from, that's right. I mean, everything has to be proved. You have to be able to prove the non-aggression principle. Ayn Rand proves the non-aggression principle. So she's the only one who legitimately can use it, in my view. They just assert it out of nowhere. And it will convince nobody. And you can't use it in that context. Well, what about self-defense? Self-defense is aggression. Is self-defense okay? Well, some libertarians and some anarchists will say no. They are pure pacifists. Not all of them are, but some of them are. So what's right? What's wrong? Where does it? What's the basis? You have to have a philosophical basis. And this is what objectivism is. It's the philosophical foundation. The objectivist morality, the objectivist epistemology and metaphysics are the objective philosophical foundation for the non-aggression principle. And libertarians go nowhere without objectivism as their foundation. Unfortunately, most of them, certainly most anarchists, reject objectivism exactly for that. Okay, I tend to become really angry when I debate liberals. Once it becomes apparent that they are too stupid for me to communicate with using facts and logic, I switch to tearing them to shreds to make examples out of them. Does this style help or hurt objectivism? Well, it probably helps you because you get to be angry and you get to feel pleased with yourself. But I think at the end of the day, it hurts objectivism. I don't think it helps. And it really depends. Is this one-on-one? Is there an audience? I think at the end of the day, what helps objectivism is for us to be seen as rational, as fact-based, as not tolerant in the sense of accepting of the other side's arguments as credible, but tolerant in the sense of not going off the handle because we don't agree with somebody, right? Disagree passionately, but disagree with reason and with facts. And I think part of the problem is that indeed objectivists turn people off by how aggressive they are, by how nasty they are, by how rude they are. And I think if you see me do Q&As, I think that's a good model for this, I think. I mean, you guys correct me if I'm wrong. But I try to be benevolent. I mean, I'll get angry once in a while, but I don't try to rip them to shreds. That's not my purpose. I try to make the most cogent argument I can. And in debates, I don't feel like I'm debating the guy on the left. I'm not going to convince this guy. I'm debating the audience, and I'm debating inside the mind of any honest individual. So you have to present your arguments as if your opponent is honest, because the person listening hopefully is honest, and they're the ones you're trying to get at, not the guy you're debating. The guy you're debating is irrelevant to what's going on. That's how I view a debate. I don't debate the guy on stage with me. I debate with the audience. Now, I have to respond to his arguments because that's what the audience is hearing. But it's the audience that I care about. It's the audience I'm trying to impress. It's the audience I'm trying to get to think. It's the audience I'm hoping to get to go back home and Google what I had to say and Google Ayn Rand and go read a book. So you want to come off professional, knowledgeable, benevolent, you know, and reasonable. You want to be the representative of reason, not the representative of anger, frustration, emotion.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.